From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, journalist Marianne Pearl. Her husband, journalist Daniel Pearl, was kidnapped and murdered by Islamic extremists in Pakistan last year. He was the South Asia bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal and was investigating connections between a radical Pakistani cleric and Richard Reed, the shoe bomber. She's written a memoir about the end of his life called A Mighty Heart. Also, we talk with Newsweek's Jerusalem bureau chief, Joshua Hammer. His new book chronicles last year's siege of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem when Palestinian gunmen took it over after Israeli tanks and troops moved into Bethlehem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House faced more questions today about an investigation into leaks that exposed the identity of a CIA officer in the news media. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president has ordered his staff to fully cooperate with the investigation, but at the daily briefing by the press secretary, there were plenty of questions about what that means. Scott McClellan dismissed as hypothetical inquiries about whether White House staffers would submit to polygraph tests if asked. He was also asked about presidential adviser Karl Rove and if Rove took steps to make sure the newspaper report containing the leak got wider play after it appeared.
We're not going to go down every single allegation that someone makes. We can do that all day long. Let's stay focused on what the issue is here.
McClellan said that documents and data are being preserved in compliance with a Justice Department demand and that so far no White House staffers have been contacted by investigators for interviews. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
President Bush has signed a bill that provides $30 billion in new funding for the Department of Homeland Security. The president told workers at the department's Washington headquarters that their work is essential to the war on terrorism.
Our nation refuses to live in fear. And the best way to overcome fear and to frustrate the plans of our enemies is to be prepared and resolute at home and to take the offensive abroad.
The appropriation includes almost $5 billion for the Transportation Security Administration and about $6 billion for border security. The chairman of the Federal Communications Commission is asking telemarketers to help him enforce the national Do Not Call list, which a federal court has called unconstitutional. Today is the first day the list was to go into effect. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
FCC Chairman Michael Powell is asking telemarketers to share their copy of the 50 million phone numbers on the list. The Federal Trade Commission, which gathered the names, is no longer allowed to enforce the list because of the court ruling. The Federal Communications Commission says it can enforce the list, but the agency can't get a copy because the judge in the cases told the agencies they cannot share the information. So the FCC is asking the Direct Marketing Association to share its copy of the list so the agency can bring enforcement actions against telemarketers. The chairman also wants the names of telemarketers who have accessed the list. The FCC expects companies that have downloaded the list to observe the Do Not Call rules or face possible fines. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 194 points, or about 2.1%, to close at 9,469 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 45 points, or about 2.5%. It closed at 1,832. This is NPR News. Unions at Amtrak, the nation's passenger rail service, have put off a one-day strike that was scheduled for Friday. The unions, representing about 8,000 engineers, mechanics, and other workers, had planned the walkout to pressure Congress to provide the $1.8 billion in funding the railroad has asked for. The unions now say they want to give a federal judge more time to determine if the strike would violate federal law. Illinois State Police say at least 7 people were killed and 16 others injured today in a collision involving a mini tour bus on Interstate 90 west of Chicago. NPR's David Shaper reports.
Illinois State Police say 2 semi-tractor trailers, a pickup truck, and a mini tour bus were involved in the crash, which happened around 3 o'clock Central Time, about 45 miles west of Chicago, and just a half mile west of a toll plaza between the towns of Marengo and Hampshire, Illinois. A state police spokesman says it appears as though one of the trucks failed to slow down as vehicles ahead of it slowed for the approaching toll booths. and the truck then rammed into the other vehicles from behind, setting off a chain reaction. The International Women's Association of Chicago says a group of its members were in the minibus. They were returning to the city from a day trip to Rockford, and several apparently are among the victims. Interstate 90 remained closed in both directions for several hours after the crash. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
Police in Sacramento, California say a teenager and a school administrator are hospitalized, and the teenager with a gunshot wound after allegedly taking the administrator hostage at a local high school. Police say officers shot 19-year-old Mario Rodriguez in the shoulder, leaving him in critical but stable condition. They say he entered the school with a shotgun. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Radio Shack, featuring the new Radio Shack MasterCard credit card. Details in stores. Radio Shack. You've got questions, we've got answers.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is journalist Marianne Pearl, the widow of Daniel Pearl, who was kidnapped and beheaded by Islamic extremists in Pakistan last year. Daniel Pearl was the South Asia bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. When Marianne last saw him, he was on his way to a meeting with the radical Islamic cleric Sheikh Mubarak Ali Shah Jalani in the hopes of investigating his connection to Richard Reid, the alleged shoe bomber. In July of 2002, a special anti-terrorism court in Pakistan found Ahmed Omar Sheikh and three accomplices guilty of the kidnapping and murder. Omar Sheikh, who organized the kidnapping, was sentenced to death, the other three to life imprisonment. They are appealing. Marianne Pearl was 6 months pregnant when her husband was killed. She was in Pakistan reporting for French public television and radio. The Pearls often traveled together on assignment. She's written a new book about the life and death of her husband called A Mighty Heart. Before we talk about your husband and your book, I just want to ask you for your reaction to some conclusions in a new book about your husband by the French writer Bernard-Henri Lévy. He says that your husband was killed because he was on the verge of exposing connections between al-Qaeda and the Pakistani government. And he also said that your husband was on the verge of exposing connections between the between al-Qaeda, between Islamic extremists and nuclear weapons. He said that Pakistan's nuclear weapons are in the hands of Islamic extremists, and your husband was on the verge of discovering more information about that. Does this sound true to you?
This does sound true to a certain extent. That is to say that after 2 months after the World Trade Center attacks, all the journalists were investigating, I mean the main journalists were investigating on the links between Pakistan intelligence agencies, the current elements or ex-members, agents, and the al-Qaeda network, and particularly concerning weapons of mass destruction. Pakistan has a nuclear weapon. Were they facilitating it to al-Qaeda? That was the question Danny was investigating, absolutely. To assert that Danny was on the verge of finding the actual relationship and the names, it is possible. I don't think that he was the only one. I think that, it was, it's a complex story, but in the end, like after 2 months of reporting, things do come together. And Danny was very good at putting things together and reaching some conclusion. I mean, even if people are trying to hide. So Bernard Lévy's guess remains a guess because we don't have facts. It's not for sure, but I also think that that's what, obviously that's what the people were doing in Pakistan. That's what why the main newspapers sent the journalists in Pakistan at that time. That was the question for the world, of course.
Lévy also says that your husband's killer was a member of the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, and that the Pakistani government may be sheltering more men who were involved in his murder. Any reaction to that?
I'm trying to remain very close to truth and objectivity and not speculate so much. We don't know to this day exactly who were the three people who came the last day at the compound where Danny was held and killed him. So they likely could be members of the ISI, probably more supported by the ISI than members of the ISI, I would say. That's something we haven't proved yet.
But it's something you think might be true.
It's something that might be true. It might be that maybe members of the ex-ISI, as I call them, which is the people who have been dismissed, who had just been dismissed by President Musharraf, who at the time, again, had been banning jihadi movements. So that these people had links with the ex-ISI, there is no doubt about that, that they had been protected. The same way Umar Sheikh, who was the mastermind kidnapper, was, you know, had links with the ISI.
Do you think your husband was killed just as, like, to set an example to other journalists, or do you think he was killed because he was on the verge of revealing major information?
I do not know that answer, Terry. I don't know yet. It might be possible that he was killed just because he was Jewish, or just because they wanted to scare other journalists and keep them away from Pakistan because there was something to hide. It's possible that they wanted to kill him because he was American only.
To your knowledge, what was your husband investigating when he met with Omar Saeed Sheikh?
Do you mean at the time? Did they know what he was doing? Oh, no.
What did you know then, and what do you know now?
Well, I knew what he was doing. I knew again, like, you know, everybody was trying to find out how much Pakistan had helped the hijackers of 9/11 hijackers in their plot to destroy the towers. So there was this story that had come up in the Boston Globe that I had read at the time saying, oh, maybe the spiritual leader of Omar Saeed Sheikh is in Pakistan, is in Karachi, and he is still in his madrasa and giving classes to this young man, potential terrorist. So I knew that. I knew that we were trying to find the links, and we were trying to find the electronic links, also the email, tracing emails. I did not know so much about Jilani, who is the person that was allegedly the spiritual leader of Omar Sheikh. I didn't know that he had so much record on in America, for like his organization was in the terrorist list of the FBI for a long time, and then was removed just because there was no activity recorded. But so I didn't know exactly the nature of Jilani, but I did know the nature of Richard Reid, like the rest of the world, and I had like a remote idea of, I mean, I knew Danny was going to go in a madrasa, which was fine. Like, we had gone to those madrasas a number of times. That's what you do when you report in Karachi or in Pakistan. I mean, you get too close to these people, otherwise you can't do your work. So I wasn't that particularly worried. The reason I would accompany him on those kind of travels, but that day first of all, I had an interview myself. I was doing, as I said before to you, that I was doing a documentary for French radio at the time, so I was recording an interview. And the second thing, we had been in the region for 3 months, and it had been very, very intense 3 months, of course, after the World Trade Center attacks, and I was really tired of hearing the same jihadi speeches again. So I decided not to go with him, but I was not particularly alarmed that day.
You knew one of the things that your husband was investigating was the possibility of a link between Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, and the radical Muslim cleric Sheikh Mubarak Ali Jilani, who was in Karachi.
Right.
So you knew that he was investigating that. Were there other things that you thought he was investigating as well, or that in retrospect you know now that he was investigating?
Yes, there was a number of things, but first let me know that the question he's trying to answer was Jilani more than just a spiritual leader? Mm-hmm. Because Richard Reid had missed the plane that he was supposed to take in Paris, that he wanted to blow, and he had sent an email in Karachi that had just been established, that the email had been sent in Karachi, and the answer had been provided from Karachi saying, just take the next plane and blow it up. right? So so there was something very newsy there that was happening. Now, in the meantime, of course, then he was working on different stories. One of them, of course, was following up on what is the situation with the nuclear weapon program and any relationship with Al-Qaeda. That was like an ongoing story because no one had really proved anything. And that was, of course, the main topic for the rest of the world, right? But that's what he was doing all the time. So mainly those different, those two axes, the nuclear weapon program and the links between Pakistan and Al-Qaeda.
Before your husband decided to actually take the risk and meet with a disciple of Sheikh Jilani, he asked people for advice, and the advice he basically got was, it's okay as long as you meet him in a public place.
Right.
Was he confident, was your husband confident that if he met Jilani in a public place that he'd be safe? And was he confident that their meeting would really be in a public place?
He was absolutely, Danny was absolutely confident that that meeting with someone who could be dangerous in a public place was a safe way to go, because that's what we do all the time. That's the only way you can actually approach those people. And because he had asked us questions to three different people, I am sure that he remained confident that the meeting would happen in that restaurant where they had their appointment.
And do you know if they actually first met in a public place and then he got abducted, or how the kidnapping actually happened?
As far as we know, yes, they did meet at that place, but I do not know how the kidnapping actually happened. I don't know if anybody pulled a gun or just pushed him in a car or just convinced him that he was just going a few meters away and to get in a car. I don't know yet that answer.
Now, you write in your book that you and your husband used to signal each other when you were alone, that you'd like to report together, and you usually accompanied each other. But when you couldn't, you'd signal each other so that, you know, you'd be able to relay to the other that, you know, that you were safe or that he was safe. When did you realize, after not hearing from your husband, that chances were he wasn't safe?
Very quickly, because there was some kind of sensation that I had that made me feel uncomfortable. So I started calling him. We would usually call each other every 90 minutes. That was the standard time. But I started calling him before. Like, I just wanted some kind of reassurance. Something in me was uncomfortable. So very quickly I started calling, and the phone was off. I don't know if it was off or if it was out of range, but this voice kept coming back, and Danny would not answer. So very quickly, about his meeting was at, I think, 7, and at 8 o'clock I started calling, actually.
My guest is journalist Marianne Pearl. She's written a memoir about her husband, the late journalist Daniel Pearl, called A Mighty Heart. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Marianne Pearl, the journalist who is now the widow of Daniel Pearl, the reporter from the Wall Street Journal, who was killed by Islamic radicals in Pakistan. Now, some people say, well, you know, Daniel Pearl took a risk that he probably shouldn't have taken in meeting with this man. And, you know, if he were more experience, if he would have thought more about it, he wouldn't have taken that kind of risk. And you say in your book that he always played it really safe, and he refused to be a war correspondent. He didn't want to be in a war zone. When the Wall Street Journal, his newspaper, wanted to send him from Islamabad into Afghanistan after September 11th, he refused to go. And he even wrote a memo to the Wall Street Journal outlining several of the reasons why he didn't want to go. What were some of the reasons why he thought it that... I mean, he was basically accusing the paper of not looking out enough for the safety of its reporters in war zones.
Yes, Terry, let me first tell you that Danny, if Danny was had just made a mistake, I would admit it. You know, I would be honest enough to admit that that day he just get carried away because it's just a human thing to do. But it's not true. Danny was a really safe, safety conscious person, definitely more than I am. Everybody does that kind of thing when they work as foreign correspondent. You just report. That's what you do. Otherwise, you can't work, or you just stay in a hotel room and then you pretend you report. So that there was no options there. As far as the Wall Street Journal is concerned, Danny, to just let you know that I'm not inventing that, he wrote this safety memo because, contrary to what people say, he was an experienced journalist and he had covered dangerous zones. And after one of them in Kosovo, he had written a safety memo to the Wall Street Journal saying, "Yes, you send us there, but you don't even remember that you're sending us to war," because that was his own experience. He had been in Kosovo, and when he talked to his boss back in New York, the person said, "Oh, I forgot where you are," right? So then he was really angry at that. And he wrote a memo that was for his safety, but for all foreign correspondents' safety. And it was a very detailed memo saying, "We need that to be out of danger."
Yeah, one of the things he said in that memo was, "Several times I've told my editor or the news assistant that I'll be checking in daily and they should call if they don't hear from me. But when I went a few days without checking in, I never got a call."
Right, that's one of the examples. He was asking for check-ins. He was asking for equipment. He was asking for cash. Just elements that would and training and safety training, and even he's even talking about kidnapping situation. So he's asking more training because he's saying basically that the Wall Street Journal, in a way, positions itself as a newspaper that's not news. It's a newspaper, but it's like more economic, and it doesn't go to war. It doesn't go on the front line. And it was, obviously wrong. We were in the front line and we were mandated there. So it was obviously wrong.
When your husband was missing and you knew he was in serious trouble, you wanted to convince his kidnappers to release him. You were about 6 months pregnant at the time. The journalists of the world were trying to interview you. What were some of the things you thought about in deciding what your public role should be and how you should publicly present yourself, in a way that could possibly help save your husband?
Right. The only thought I had in my head when we decided that I should try to make a public appearance on television was maybe Danny's watching me, which means the way I wanted to present myself is communicate with him and say I'm here, like I'm strong, like I'm with you, we are together. I just like wanted to convey that message to him that I was not destroyed or anything like that. That the baby was fine. So that was my main. My main concern, and my only concern, really. I also thought if he's watching me, then his captors also are watching me. To these people also, I am going to tell them, if you think you've taken everything away from me, it's wrong. You're not achieving your aim, which is, they were trying to terrify you. So I was not terrified. I was just trying to have a language of common sense. And I thought, based on my experience of talking with these people, that was the best thing to do, as opposed to, be crying on TV.
Did you think that it would be possible to get sympathy from the terrorists because you and your husband were expecting a baby?
I did not think I could expect sympathy from terrorists. The only thing I could hope was that they were publicity hungry and they wanted a lot of attention, and then they'll release Danny because that was their plan in the first place. That's the only thing I could hope for. The people who have destroyed 3,000 lives in the World Trade Center, of people who had not done nothing to them and they were completely innocent, would not release Danny because I was pregnant. I knew that since day one.
You got a series of four photographs of your husband before he was executed. Would you just describe those photos?
When we received those photos, we were all waiting for signs. We had been without any kind of message for 3 days. I was surrounded by people that helped me read those photos. Those photos, the first one was Danny with a gun pointed on his head, and he had his head down. You could see, it's a very strange picture because you can see he's smiling, which is, of course, a message, the same message that I would have had on television, right, by being strong. The second photo is him with shackles on his hand, but he's also doing the finger, you know, giving the finger, you say, I
mm-hmm.
think,
yeah.
you know, and on two of those pictures. So in all of them, he managed to communicate his state of mind and his strength and everything, his love and his defiance. So he was at the same time, of course, scary to see him with a gun pointed at his head. But at the same time, it was very comforting because I knew he was exactly in the same state of mind than I was.
His execution was videotaped, and at the end, he's on tape saying, "My father is Jewish, my mother is Jewish, I am Jewish." Do you think he was told to say that?
I think he might have been told to say that, he was Jewish. But what he wasn't told, because that wouldn't have been possible, was that his grandfather had a street named after him in a little village in Israel. And so that's an information that only his family could know, only I could know. And that's his way of saying, I am proud of who I am, and that's how I'm going to die.
Do you think a lot about the attitude with which he faced death? And when you think about his attitude, do you find that comforting or upsetting?
His attitude is very comforting. I mean, it's so comforting. It may not be the right word, but I constantly come back to that moment when faced with first, and I mean, he couldn't avoid his death. There was nothing he could do. But faced by people who wanted to kill him for who he was, he decided to be proud of who he was. That strength and that courage he had is something I always come back to in mind to go on with my life or to do what I have to do. And, you know, when I'm very too sad, I just always come back to that moment and gather strength from it.
Marianne Pearl has written a memoir about her late husband called A Mighty Heart. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader. Available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Warner Home Video, featuring the films of James Cagney, Humphrey Bogart, and Errol Flynn in the new Warner Legends collection on DVD. From Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Mission Flats, a novel of suspense set in Boston by William Landay, and by Nonesuch Records, now featuring the Randy Newman Songbook, Volume 1, the first ever solo studio album by Randy Newman, with all new recordings, available at all Barnes & Noble Music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with journalist Marianne Pearl, widow of journalist Daniel Pearl. Also, we talk with Newsweek's Jerusalem Bureau Chief, Joshua Hammer. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Marianne Pearl. She's written a memoir about her late husband, Daniel Pearl, called A Mighty Heart. He was the Wall Street Journal's South Asia bureau chief and was investigating connections to Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. On the way to a planned meeting with a radical Islamic cleric, he was kidnapped and later beheaded by Islamic extremists. When we left off, we were talking about the videotape the extremists made of Pearl's execution. How did you find out that he was executed?
I found out because the video was out. For 2 weeks, we didn't know what had happened. And then suddenly the video was out, was released by the people who had edited it. So the FBI had a call and received the video, and all the investigative team went to Randall Bennett's house, was one of the investigators, and watched the video and authenticated it. So then they came back to the house and they told me.
That video ended up on the internet. One news organization, at least one news organization, played part of it. You were very upset that it was being circulated. You've never seen it yourself.
No, I haven't seen it, no.
Can you talk a little bit about your reaction to the circulation of the video?
The reason why they killed Danny the way they killed him, beheaded him, and taped this whole his murder was to the sole purpose was to show that video and terrify people. So it was a strategy. Of course, you know, they send out those tapes to news organizations and put it on the internet because that was their point, that was their goal. Now it was up to the news organization to decide what to do with these images. The fact that they had at least one news organization, which is CBS, decided to broadcast it was very sad. Not so much because. It's because it's vulgar, but more because that's exactly what the terrorists wanted them to do. And that the fact that they didn't understand that for a country that had just been hit by terrorism so hard, that made me angry, very angry.
What about the vulgar aspects of it? What about the aspect that there are people in the country who saw your husband being beheaded on video?
You know, there is a dark side or animal side in human beings that are attracted to, those kind of images. It's like lower instincts, right? Basic instincts. You can appeal to that because that, you know, generates interest, generates money, generates viewing and ratings. It's a responsibility to broadcast those images, you know. And the only reason that I found on the internet, because there were people chatting about it, should they do it, should they not do it, the only reason for it was freedom of expression. It's completely wrong. That's not a freedom of expression. That's pure, pure animal instinct, the same way there are videos about people being murdered, I mean, all kinds of other murders or rapes or that kind of, that's how low it is. There's nothing there. There's nothing there in terms of, the reason that was explained to me was it's newsworthy, and it wasn't newsworthy, you know. It was no news. Like, we knew what had happened to Danny. It was just, voyeurism. I don't know the word in English. It's, when you want to...
Voyeurism.
Voyeurism, exactly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Marianne Pearl, and she's written a new book about the kidnapping and murder of her husband, the journalist Daniel Pearl. How has the kidnapping and murder of your husband affected your willingness to travel or the kind of journalism that you practice?
It made me more determined to do what we did together. One of my challenges, you know, what I did for me to survive was that I listed all the goals that the terrorists had. You know, I did the opposite of CBS, and I decided to deny them all those goals. So one of those goals was to instill fear in me, of traveling, of others, of, you know, make me lose my confidence. And I fought very hard so that they, you know, they wouldn't achieve that goal. So I'm still very much interested by, you know, the human race and our world. And Danny taught me so much about, you know, good journalism and objectivity and truth. I will definitely go on.
How old is your son now?
He's 16 months. He walks.
Good.
He talks.
Good. Well, you know, in a few years, you'll have to kind of figure out how much to tell him and how much to protect him from. Have you started to figure out already what the right equation is of what to reveal and what to keep from him for a while?
I haven't really figured out how I'm going to deal with this issue. It's something, of course, obviously, that keeps me very, you know, worried, and, you know, thinking also. I figured that the best thing I could do is, in the meantime, before the time comes to sit down with him and tell him that his father was murdered, first of all, write this book for him, so that he can know the truth. If everything that I've written, I make it true in my daily life, then Adam will be all right. I mean, it's going to be, of course, difficult. Like, he's going to have to bear his burden, and I'm bearing mine. But we'll be together, and hopefully he'll... what he retained mostly in his heart will be to be a kind of man his father would be proud of.
Are you living in France or the United States now?
In New York City. Yeah, in the village.
How do you like it there?
I like it. Now, you know, I came here to write this book, so it was a very difficult year for me, very lonely and cold and a difficult year. So New York was a good shelter for me because it's such a mix of everything. So I could, like, lose myself a little bit in New York City. But it was difficult, obviously. Now, it's better now. I have friends. I've, you know, created a little environment, so it's getting better and better.
Marian Pearl, I really want to thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marian Pearl's book about her late husband, Daniel Pearl, is called A Mighty Heart. Coming up, Newsweek's Jerusalem Bureau Chief, Joshua Hammer. This is Fresh Air. My guest Joshua Hammer has been Newsweek's Jerusalem bureau chief since the fall of 2000. He's written a new book called A Season in Bethlehem, Unholy War in a Sacred Place. It's about Israel's invasion of the West Bank town of Bethlehem in April 2002. Bethlehem is the city in which it is believed Jesus was born. The final chapter is about the siege of the Church of the Nativity when Palestinian gunmen forced their way into the church, beginning a 39-day standoff with the Israeli troops that surrounded the church. Hammer was in a nearby hotel at the beginning of the siege. After it ended, he pieced together what happened by profiling several of the people who were there, including a Palestinian militant, an Israeli soldier, the governor of Bethlehem, and a priest. I asked Hammer why the Palestinian gunmen took over the Church of the Nativity.
Palestinian gunmen moved into the church because they believed, quite rightly, that it would offer them protection. I think they were totally stunned by the size of the and force of the Israeli invasion of Bethlehem. And they knew through experience, through history, that the Church of the Nativity has been there through the centuries as a place of refuge. Most recently in the 1967 war, Palestinians took refuge there during the bombing, Jordanian and Israeli bombings that went on there. So it was always there. It was always in the back of their minds. And when the Israeli tanks and troops advanced down towards, basically chased the militants through the streets of the old city down to Manger Square in front of the Church of the Nativity, It was on everybody's mind. Go to the church. They shot the locks off the Franciscan monastery, poured into the church. 200, 250 of them went in there, and then waited to see how the Israelis would respond.
Is there a point of view that you were exposed to from the people who were at the Church of the Nativity during the siege that seemed incomprehensible to you before that you feel you understand better now as a result of this reporting?
Well, I think that I, in the course of reporting this book and in the course of being a reporter in the Middle East, went through the kind of experience that Father Parthenios, the Greek Orthodox priest in my book, underwent. He was a person who was viewed these Palestinian militants from a distance, was suspicious of them, didn't really know what they represented, tended to lump them all together, was frightened of them. In the course of being trapped with them over 39 days, he began to sympathize with their plight and their political views. Now, I am not saying that I particularly admired any of these people, but I went through a similar experience as Father Parthenios in getting to know these people as human beings and not just as these sort of cardboard, homicidal, killer terrorist figures that are so easily caricatured, especially by the Israeli government.
What are some of the qualities that Father Parthenios or you found in the militant gunmen who took over the church that seemed more sympathetic?
One of the things that struck me about so many of these people was how jail had transformed them. Jail was a crucible that shaped their personalities. Now, I'm not talking about the Second Intifada. I'm talking about jail in the 1980s. Many of them, as kids, were throwing stones in the streets of Bethlehem during that first Intifada in the 1980s, were arrested at the age of 14, 15, 16, thrown into Israeli prisons, often tortured, certainly beaten, harshly interrogated, and made to languish in Israeli jails for years. You could draw a 3-year or 4-year prison sentence for throwing a rock back in those days. What struck me most is how important that experience was in shaping the mentality, in shaping the animosity, in shaping the militancy that drives so many of these young men 10, 12, 14 years later.
One of the people you profiled was one of the militants behind the siege, and that was Ibrahim Abayat, a Fatah guerrilla leader. Tell us something about him and his reasons for being part of that siege.
Well, Abayat and his whole extended family, the Abayats, are a fascinating group in Bethlehem. They come out of a nomadic background, from the Judean wilderness near the Dead Sea. They are traditionally the car thieves, arms dealers, all around tough guys of Bethlehem. They basically formed the bedrock of the militant of the armed groups in Bethlehem when the Intifada began. He was a very interesting character because he was notorious well before the Intifada began. He carried out the first so-called honor killing in the region in a generation. He and his first cousin found out that their first cousin, a woman, had been allegedly carrying out an extramarital affair, kidnapped both her and her alleged lover, and executed them both. There was a big celebrated trial. He was found guilty. His clansmen went on a rampage through the streets of Bethlehem, burning houses, burning cars. A guy whose life was very much embedded in these Muslim Bedouin traditions that came out in this violent way. So by the time the Intifada began, he was well known as a notorious character in the city, and he lived up to that reputation.
How did he behave inside during the siege?
Ibrahim Ebayat was a hot-tempered, unpredictable, dangerous character. Inside, he was jumpy. He contemplated a bloody breakout, just storming out through the door of humility, and most likely being killed. He intimidated people. Anybody who was thinking about trying to leave, he would call a collaborator, threaten them explicitly with death. He was one of the figures who kept people in line. Basically, he was the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades.
You describe him toward the end of the siege, and you write, plagued by migraines, hungry and weak, gone was the confidence of the gunman who had once strutted around Bethlehem, who had vowed to go out either a winner or a martyr. Now he was feebly pleading for exile. How was he changed, do you think, during the course of that long siege, and how did it affect
I think, like many, I won't say all, but many of these militants, with 2020 hindsight, one sees that so much of what they did was posturing, that essentially they were cowards. Ibrahim Abayat took the easy way out, essentially. He surrendered. At the end, he realized he was up against a very powerful force, that his options were accept exile or die, and he meekly accepted exile. So he was a very changed, humbled figure by the end of it.
What is his reputation now among other militants?
It's hard to say, because the militant groups of Bethlehem have pretty much been decimated. I think he's forgotten, and I think it. I visited him in Spain several months after the siege was over, and he was dispatched to exile, and it killed him. I think it just crushed him psychologically to know that he was quickly being forgotten.
One of the people who you write about during the siege is one of your neighbors, who is an Israeli who was actually born in Southern California and immigrated to Jerusalem in 1973 after the Yom Kippur War. He was a reservist who was called to active duty during the siege. 15 young soldiers under his command. What were some of his concerns during the siege of Bethlehem?
I think first and foremost, it was his concern for the life of the young men under his command. He was a 32-year-old reservist, so he was concerned going in the course of those long hours before the battle actually began, rumbling in his armored personnel carrier into Bethlehem in the darkness, that these militants were going to put up a real fight and there would likely be some death among the young men that he was leading into battle, and that he would possibly be killed himself. He was very, very conflicted about the whole thing. As I write in the book, he was the son of a leader, one of the leaders of the Peace Now movement, had grown up in this very, very left-wing home. Now he was riding in an armored personnel carrier, leading men into battle against these Palestinians whom he had always sympathized with. So he was a very conflicted person.
And did he stay conflicted after the siege was over?
Well, Mike Aviad went through the conversion process that so many Israelis had gone through over the last couple of years, which is definitely drifted more and more towards the right. Didn't vote for Ariel Sharon in 2001, the first election, but really viewed Arafat as a terrorist and was fully supportive of Ariel Sharon's decision to send a massive invade the West Bank in a massive way. By the end of the siege, I think he came out of it feeling, I don't know if this is going to achieve anything ultimately. I'm not sure. We're not going to stamp out this rebellion. We're not going to stamp out this uprising, but we have to do something.
Your new book is about the siege of the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem and about the Israeli incursion into Bethlehem. What are some of the different lessons that you think Israelis, particularly Israelis in the government and the cabinet, took away from that incursion into Bethlehem? I imagine different people have taken different messages.
Well, I would say that it breaks down into two camps, and the two camps are still warring today.
Mm-hmm.
One camp would say that the Bethlehem operation exemplified how you can, in fact, subdue terror with military force and military force alone. Since the invasion of Bethlehem, the amount of violence that's been coming out of that particular area, in fact, the entire West Bank has dropped dramatically. There's no question that there have been many fewer suicide bombings, many few sniper attacks, attacks on soldiers. The violence has dropped dramatically in that year and a half. On the other hand, there would be others who took away from the invasion of Bethlehem and the invasion of the West Bank the very opposite lesson, as we saw only a couple of weeks ago in this heavily locked down, West Bank, where it's very difficult to move from town to town, even outside your own village, Hamas was able to get two suicide bombers across the Green Line dividing Israel from the West Bank, blow themselves up in both Tel Aviv and Jerusalem in a cafe three blocks from my house, and cause 15, 16 deaths. So they would say, look, you've entered the West Bank, you've locked it down, you're creating all of this additional misery and hatred, and they're still getting through. So these two sides are still arguing, and there isn't a resolution.
It was the hope of some people within the Bush administration that war in Iraq would lead to a peace in the Middle East, you know, through a revival of the roadmap to peace. The roadmap is now off the table. Right now, how does it look like the war in Iraq has affected the possibility of a Middle East peace?
Well, look, I never saw the connection, and a lot of my colleagues and a lot of the people I talked to there always thought that was specious. What was the link between Iraq and the Palestinians? I mean, there was a link, direct link. Okay, Saddam was writing out checks, $25,000 here and there to the families of suicide bombers. He expressed his support for the Palestinian cause. I never saw the link. I see the Palestinian-Israeli dynamic as being unique, as being very independent from what goes on 500 miles away in Iraq. And I don't think, and I never did think, and I still don't think, that the dynamic of Iraq will in any way affect this sort of cycle of revenge and retaliation and hatred that continues to defeat any attempts to make a peace deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I just don't see the link.
My guest is Joshua Hammer, Newsweek's Jerusalem bureau chief. His new book about the Israeli invasion of Bethlehem is called A Season in Bethlehem. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joshua Hammer. He reports from Jerusalem for Newsweek. He has a new book called A Season in Bethlehem, Unholy War in a Sacred Place. Your previous book, Chosen by God, was a book about your brother who became a Hasidic Jew and is now living in Israel. Where is he living?
No, he's actually living in Muncie, New York,
about 30
miles north of New York. It began in Israel, his conversion, so to speak, if you can refer to a Jew becoming an extremely religious Jew, a conversion, took place in Israel about 22 years ago. But he quickly moved to New York and found his way into a community in north of New York City. A mixed community, modern Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, and Hasidim.
Mm-hmm. I know he's your brother, but would you consider him an extremist? Or
yes, I would consider him an extremist. He wouldn't consider himself an extremist. But I would think even within the spectrum of ultra-Orthodoxy, he would be at the extreme end of it. For instance, he's one of those ultra-Orthodox Jews who believes that the state of Israel has no right to exist until the Messiah comes, which is a fairly fringe position, and still appears to fervently believe that. It's one of the reasons that he's never gone back to Israel.
Do you think that you try to be any more open-minded in your ability to kind of understand the acts of political or religious extremists because someone in your family has become so extreme?
I don't know if I'm more tolerant or accepting of it. I'm more inclined to understand everything I can about it. I was drawn in my book, Chosen by God, to go back to my own family and dig up history and find out what are the psychological factors that drive somebody to embrace Hasidic Judaism from a totally secular, almost atheistic background, to make that kind of leap. So in the same way, I suppose I was driven to explore, for instance, what would make an 18-year-old girl somebody, you know, pretty much the same age as my brother was when he made his conversion, to go from being a promising student in Bethlehem, looking forward to a college career, as my brother was, who was engaged to be married and lived a very traditional life, was swept up in the fervor surrounding her, and strapped on a suicide belt and blew herself up at the age of 18 and killed two people in March 2002. Now, I am, of course, I'm not equating my brother's choice in any way with suicide bombers in Palestine. I'm just saying these are two manifestations of an extreme belief and a willingness to surrender completely to that belief, sometimes with violent consequences. So, yeah, it's intriguing to me. I would say perhaps that my experience with my brother led me toward this path, inevitably toward this path.
Do you think that being Jewish affects your coverage of the Middle East?
I hope it doesn't. I think it enrages certain people within the Israeli government and certain Israelis that I meet who believe that there should be a natural embrace of Israel, and a natural embrace of everything it does, and an identification with the state of siege that it finds itself in, and that any defense whatsoever of the Palestinians or any attempt to sort of explain, humanize these people is somehow defines one as a self-hating Jew and makes one suspect. I think there's a good deal. I've heard that a lot. Even a couple of weeks ago, or last week when I was on my book tour, I was accused of, a woman got up and called me traitor. But I try not to let that bother me. I do believe in the state of Israel, have a natural sympathy for the state of Israel, but I think there's a huge difference between having sympathy and belief, firm belief in the state of Israel, and blindly endorsing some of the excesses, some of the policies that I believe this current Israeli government is pursuing in the name of making peace, in the name of providing security to its people. I don't think it's working. I think it's often counterproductive. I think it's causing an awful lot of misery. And I'm aware when I say these things that I'm opening myself up to intense criticism. But I don't think of myself, I suppose, as a Jew first. I think of myself as a journalist.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Joshua Hammer is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for Newsweek. His new book is called A Season in Bethlehem. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sherrock. Connie Lockwood is our engineer. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Scholastic Press, publisher of Old Turtle and the Broken Truth, A Tale of Peace and Tolerance by Douglas Wood, and illustrator John J. Muth, a first book selection. From Calico Corners, your home for custom decorating, with over 100 stores across the country, on the web at calicocorners.com. And by Dutton Books, publisher of La Faire, a comedy of manners and culture clash by Diane Johnson, author of Le Divorce. An excerpt is available at authordianejohnson.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Well, the next Fresh Air, Paul Newman. He was nominated for a Tony last year for his role as the stage manager in Our Town. The production originated at his theater company in Westbeth, Connecticut, and is about to be shown on PBS. Also, we talk with Grover Norquist, the head of Americans for Tax Reform. He's a staunch supporter of the president's tax cuts. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.